Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lau.
So we're going to start off something new by adding a little blurb at the beginning of the episode, because we're not sure how many people actually listen to the end of the episode or stop 10 minutes in when we start arguing about movies. If you'd like to get a hold of us, there's a few different ways. We have, of course, an email, so that's info@idleredhands.com, IDLEREDHANDS.com, same as the website. We also have a Facebook page, which is Facebook/IdleRedHands. And we also have Twitter as well, so you can follow us on there. That's @IdleRedHands as well. And please, if you have any questions or comments, something we really love hearing from anybody. In fact, we get some of our best ideas out of it.
And another first, we're recording on a Saturday night.
Woo, Saturday night.
Yeah.
Yeah, way to make us all seem like losers.
Yeah, a little bit, eh?
Well, that's because we all had plans on a Friday night.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, my plans were watching Iron Man 3.
How was that?
Okay, sorry.
I saw that on the plane, so those plans don't sound so great.
Right.
How was it work?
It was better than Iron Man 2. I think I'm getting tired of Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark.
Mm.
And it might be because of the Avengers, and they reference the Avengers a lot in Iron Man 3.
Right.
Don't remember which one came out first. I'm assuming Avengers came out before Iron Man 3.
Yes, yeah.
So they reference it a lot, and you're thinking, wow, that's pretty cool. It's an integrated world.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, you're thinking, wow, they are beating everything into the ground. Like, there's references to Thor. There's references to Avengers.
Right.
Yeah. Good part, it had Guy Pearce, so he's always good.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I haven't seen him in a while, eh?
He's starting to, I don't know if you'd call it a comeback, but he's starting to appear in more movies, so.
That's good. Yeah, I miss him. He's a good actor.
Yeah, he's got a lot of range, so. When I was watching, I was wondering what it would have been like if he had been cast as Tony Stark.
Because
he can do comedy, but he can also do the other stuff as well.
Yeah, he can totally pull it off.
Robert Downey Jr. does comedy,
mm-hmm.
and doesn't do as well with the other stuff.
Right.
But it was okay. It was enjoyable. It was, wasn't a disappointment.
I'm pretty sure it came after Avengers, because it felt like, and I'm saying this without having seen Iron Man 2, it felt like it was an escalation over Iron Man 1, because my feeling is Iron Man 1 was kind of a mundane villain, you know? Where Iron Man 3, the antagonist, felt very supernatural to me. And as you said, Lyle, in the beginning of the movie, there's a lot of reference to the Avengers and Thor, and the Tony Stark character says, oh, things have kind of changed, what with the events in the Avengers movie. And I guess the writers felt they had to, you know, make the world seem bigger than it was with the introduction of what were more supernatural antagonists.
Well, the Guy Pearce character says, now that there's a guy with the hammer.
Right.
Meaning
right.
Thor. Subtlety is out. Oh, and if you hear a lot of wheezing in this episode, that's me.
Yeah, man, that was something right there. It sounded like an old door was opening.
Yeah, no, it's just my allergies just kicking in. Like, huge.
Huge.
My huge allergies. Because, yeah. You know me, I'm all about go big or go home.
Yep. Subtlety is not a trait Lyle knows.
Exactly. Now that there's a Thor movie. You know.
Hey, Thor 2 is coming out soon.
Oh, no, I can't face those allergies. Yeah. So,
I watched Looper.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I can see why people say it's one of the most intelligent time travel movies they've seen.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't fix time travel, because they're, at the end of the movie, I still did have a question. You know, it's kind of the, okay, if you go back in time and, you know, shoot Hitler kind of thing, well then would the same things happen leading you to go back in time and shoot Hitler, you know?
You
do kind of have a bit of that paradox, but again, that only came up after the movie ended, and otherwise they did some really, really interesting things with time travel, which is quite often my biggest gripe with science fiction movies. You know, okay, you have this premise and you don't do anything with it, or you can do so much more. So, yeah, I thought it was really good. And Timely review, as always, huh?
No, is that a pun based on the movie?
Oh, yeah. Hey-o. Yeah, they do some really good big things, and they also do some really good small things. And I think it's the small things that you can really drop into a game to make it seem pretty cool. I mean, when we think about time travel, I mean, you just go into like the land of the dinosaurs and you do the things there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think of that Bradbury short story,
right?
You know, you don't want to step on anything, or
yeah,
because it's going to totally influence the whole time continuum.
Right. You only want to shoot the dinosaur that was going to die anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's a big thing. But there's little things that Looper does that can make time travel a lot of fun. So, mm-hmm. I mean, what's the point of doing time travel if you only want to shoot the dinosaur that's going to die?
Right.
Because you're not affecting it.
For myself, I saw the first three episodes of Avatar, the animated TV series. And actually, unfortunately, I was a little bit disappointed by it. Because I've heard from a lot of other sources, other podcasts and whatnot, everybody just raving about how amazing it was. And a lot of people were saying how even though it's a anime cartoon, you know, you kind of expect it to be pretty kid-styled, despite being on Nickelodeon, but it's really a more of an adult kind of thing. And I think that's kind of where I was a little bit disappointed, because I was expecting something a little bit more adult, but it was still a little bit kiddie. But that said, it's, you know, it's only the first three episodes, so I will definitely watch more.
No, I actually think I got through maybe half of the first season. And, like, I was kind of disappointed, too, specifically because of exactly what you said. Like, a lot of people say, oh, it's great. And even though it's a kid's movie, or not kid's movie, even though it's like a kid's cartoon, it's kind of not, you know, it's a bit more adult. And it's just kind of, in my opinion, a standard kid's animated TV show.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I plan to go as long until, you know, I either enjoy it or I stop liking it anymore. But so we'll see what happens. But, yeah, no major gripes.
Well, you know who is pretty famous for writing kids' cartoons?
Who?
Was Edgar Allan Poe. Wow.
Yeah.
Not at all. But despite that shortcoming, he is going to be the focus of our literature lesson.
Yay.
Now I'm totally thinking of the kids' cartoon that Edgar Allan Poe would write, and man, what a depressing cartoon that would be.
Jeez. But you know, actually, I'm thinking of all the cartoons that I've seen that have redone The Raven. Like, even The Simpsons did that.
Yeah. Bart Simpson as The Raven, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, and they actually did it word for word, so.
Mm. So, yeah. Good job, Poe. You made it.
Just one of those guys after his death, you know, finally achieves the success exactly. He deserves.
Getting on The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm. I guess it doesn't really have that much to do with his writing style, but I read that Edgar Allan Poe was one of the first American writers who tried to make a living purely by writing. So,
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, say, you know, you bringing up success kind of reminded me of that. And, you know, from what I heard, as I don't know, a lot of kind of famous literary people, he was not very successful. Mm. I think he only got a total of $9 for The Raven, and think about how famous that is now.
So what we do in literature lessons is we look at some common themes that that appear in the author's work, and then we discuss each theme and discuss how we could use those in games. The first one we have is love-hate. I suppose that's kind of self-explanatory, but
but
we will explain it anyway.
You love someone and you hate him. No, but
okay, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think it's kind of important to bring up that we're talking about the same character or the same person feeling these strong emotions, mostly or quite often, for the same individual. Like the first story that comes to mind is The Telltale Heart, where, you know, the narrator is describing, spoiler, how he killed this person, but he says he didn't do it for malice, he didn't do it to get rich, he didn't do it because he hated this guy. And he says, you know, that he actually kind of loved the person he killed. And there's debate on what kind of relationship the two people have, because you're never really given names or titles, or it's never described who these people are. But the fact that in the narrator, this friendship, this love, turns to such an intense hate that leads to murder is weird. You know?
Mm-hmm.
To put it very eloquently, as Pope.
Yes.
Not to contradict you, because it, certainly there is that element, but in addition to that, there is also the love-hate, where you have the two extremes where the person's love for themselves or hatred for themselves is in conflict with their feelings with the other person. So the narrator might love themselves and then have a hatred for their rival, so it sort of distorts how they view things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I thought was pretty interesting about it that I'd never heard before is that Poe kind of had a Freudian view of love and hate, and of many other emotions for that matter, in that they're universal emotions. And universal doesn't mean that universally shared by everyone, but that they're kind of separate from the conscious mind, and maybe even separate from the mind itself. Time and place are irrelevant to these emotions. They're kind of greater than the moment, greater than the person. So when Poe writes about love and hate, he's not talking about someone's feelings of love and hate. He's talking about, like, the pure glowing emotion of love and or burning emotion of hate as well. It's almost a larger concept as well.
So it's the force.
I wouldn't have gone there, but in a sense, yeah.
Well, I just had to get that one Star Wars reference in for the episode. Well, no, that's what I was thinking of when you said it, because, you know, when you first said universal, I thought, okay, yeah, everybody shares this, and it's like, oh, no, because the way you're describing it is it's external to the person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of hard to wrap my head around it, but it's kind of the way that Poe went with it. It's just an idea to keep in mind that, you know, someone who loves another person, someone who hates another person, it's not just a matter of love or hate. It's the raw, uncut stuff. And that goes well with his stories, because that's what can drive someone so easily to do these horrible or wonderful things.
I think he shows that they're both really connected.
Mm-hmm.
And how one flips or turns into the other.
Right.
Like Wayne was talking about with the Telltale Heart. You know, he loves this guy, but he kills this guy, so something happened.
Mm-hmm.
And flipped it. That would be something good to work with, where you have someone you used to love doing something despicable, so then you hate them, or do you not hate them? I mean, those are some of the best stories, where somebody has to face a former friend.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was thinking of kind of hard-boiled or noir detective stories, and it's not exactly the same thing, but it's kind of that clouded emotion, where in Poe stories it seems a lot more kind of, you know, straightforward and black and white, and one becomes the other. But yeah, I was thinking that muddled feelings towards someone where, yeah, you know, you hate what they're doing, but you actually still love them, and, you know, maybe killing them in the end is what you have to do, and it's not out of malice, or maybe the opposite, kind of, you still love them, but you just grow to hate them so much that, yeah, you do snap and kill them.
Yeah. Oh, no, you saying about the noir, I mean, you know, walking into the detective, but doesn't necessarily need to be the detective. It could be the party of adventurers. It could be whoever. With your brother, sister, husband, wife, somebody that you do love, and who knows where that could go. You could be trying to rescue that person because you hate what they're doing now.
Right.
But you do love the person. Or you love them so much that you think that the real them would hate what they're doing, so you are hiring these people to kill them.
Hmm.
And, you know, there's a few things that you could do there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that direction, Wayne, I mean, that film noir specifically has that character written right in there, the love and hate contained within the same person, the femme fatale.
Right.
And that character's specifically there to play with that duality. And that's something I really love about Poe, is how these complex emotions can be overlaid one another, and you can, the characters can and do feel the same, different emotions at the same time, and it tears them apart psychologically.
Hmm.
It's kind of something that I wanted to get in later on when we related it more to games, but I think looking into the way the characters act in Poe's stories can be a really rich source of ways to flesh out NPCs in a game. Because oftentimes NPCs are a bit one-dimensional, at least in my games anyway. But in Poe's stories, you know, you have that where someone both loves and hates someone at the same time. It's a great way to make something a lot deeper and confusing/mysterious for your PCs.
Right. Well, speaking of kind of fleshing out NPCs and making them not one-dimensional. I think we discussed this in a previous episode, but several of Poe's stories use the unreliable narrator. You know, it's this person telling you this story, and reading it, you don't really know if they're telling you the truth. I mean, they're telling you the truth as it appeared to them, or as, you know, they remember it, but that's probably not the whole truth. You know, again, like the Telltale Heart, the guys, or the narrator is telling you about this old guy he killed and never really explains why he killed him, you know, but despite having those strong emotions for him. So, and you, Chris, saying, you know, the NPCs might feel conflicting emotions for the same person or goal or thing. Well, that kind of made me think of a lot of times in games, people expect NPCs to be entirely truthful with them when they get the information, whether they beat it out of them or whether they, you know, kind of seduce or just are friends with them to get the information. And why do people always assume that? Like, they could give you the story that they think happened that is actually different from the actual truth. And I think that would be something that's interesting or fun to play with. It, perhaps not make every NPC, you know, unreliable narrator, because then the players are just going to get frustrated. But if a few of them, or, you know, a small number of them, give conflicting information, well, then it becomes a bit of a mind puzzle to figure out exactly what is the truth. And I think that could be fun if done correctly and in small doses.
I think it could be fun and not frustrating if you've, after they unlock all the mystery, then they can figure out why the information they were getting was unreliable.
Right.
As opposed to dishonest.
Right.
And that's always interesting in a story or a movie where you're watching it or reading it, and what they say and
what they don't
the way
say.
They what they say and what they don't say and how they describe something actually triggers a clue. And you know, say, oh, he's been describing him as this, but what if instead of that he means this? You know.
No, I think that's a good, really good point, because there has to be a reason why the NPC, or in literature, the narrator, is unreliable. You know, maybe they're an alcoholic, maybe they're, you know, not quite entirely sane. But as you said, Lyle, if it's they're just being dishonest, well, then that's kind of a dumb thing to do.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, if they're describing somebody as an old man, and that's who they saw do the crime, and then you find out, well, they actually described him as an old man because of the way the person was acting, who turns out to be not an old man. Perhaps it was shuffling, you know, so it was moving slowly, hunched over. To them, that looked like an old man.
Right.
The movements, from the distance, the posture was an old man. So that helps to explain why they said that. But it actually, there's like a really big clue in that information. It's not that it was an old man. The way it was acting was like an old man. So they could have figured out, oh, it's actually undead or something like that.
So it's a very, very old man.
Then I guess they're true.
Well, that kind of circles back around to what you're saying with noir. The big mystery in a lot of noir stories isn't searching out clues. It's finding out who's telling the truth and who's hiding the truth and why.
Right.
I totally agree with the overall point, but I wouldn't quite go with unreliable narrator as the way that Poe writes his stories. I think he writes them a little bit more to where it's the minimalist narrator, because he doesn't outright deceive the audience, but he gives only the minimal amount of information that's necessary to understand what's going into the story. Like, for example, since we're on the Telltale Heart, he doesn't say anything that's untrue, but as you said, he never gives any names or descriptions or anything beyond what you absolutely need to tell the story. Which actually I think relates well to games, because when you're DMing a mystery, you don't want to overflow the information, because that'll ruin the mystery too quickly.
I read somewhere he does that so that the reader can relate to the person telling them the story. He doesn't give the person a name, so they become an every like an everyman or an everywoman,
right?
And that makes it more relatable. Which again, this thing to pull away there is to make the person telling the information relatable. I mean, we've all been in a restaurant. Some of us have worked in restaurants, so you know who the servers are and what they do. So the people serving you should be like servers that you see around you. Now, we're talking love and hate. It also comes up in William Wilson. I think my voice just cracked It sounds like I'm going through puberty.
William Wilson.
William Wilson? Yeah, there's the, it's just allergies.
Yes, Lyle's not actually going through puberty again.
Nah, that hair forming down there, that's just allergies. Those dreams I have where I wake up a little moist.
Oh.
So William Wilson is another story where you do have love and hate. In that, though, we also deal with the idea of an alter ego.
Yeah. Actually, you know, I think that's a really good point. William Wilson is probably one of the most overt examples of that, but I think that that kind of alternate identity, that duality, is a huge part of almost all of the characters in Poe's stories. Most of them, they have one, well, I suppose it's just what we were saying, you know, one side of them loves somebody and the other side of them hates something, for example. Again, like the Telltale Heart, the Cask of Amontillado, for example, where he's pretending to be this guy's best friend, and in a sense he was, but at the same time, you know, he's taking him downstairs to kill him. So, yeah, this alter ego, even present in the same person that it was as their conscious versus their subconscious, again with the Freudian stuff.
Imagine that as a villain, someone with a dual personality. I mean, that can seem a bit hackney or cliche, but I think done right, that could be a really effective villain for a story.
Yeah, especially in the reveal.
Yeah, I think we've tried personally to do the taking over of a character, of an actual player,
mm-hmm.
and have them playing essentially two people. Yeah, but in that, they were actually completely taken over with the person assumed their form.
Mm-hmm.
And the player ended up, you know, was playing the other person as in addition to playing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But to actually have this key NPC that you're interacting with also going around doing something like horrible and turning out to be the villain would be pretty good. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the only danger is that players tend to be very, very suspicious of NPCs anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I was just wondering, like, how would you do this differently from the spy in the group then? Because that's very similar, where, you know, someone in the group that the PCs trust or are friends with is going to betray them. And, like, would you do it the same way if you're doing the alter ego? Or would you do it differently? Because it sounds kind of similar.
Well, one thing with the alter ego you could do where the person's not aware of what their alter ego is doing.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Like, they don't understand it themselves. You could do it where the person really regrets what they did as the alter ego.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they do know and they're haunted by it, which is, that's something that comes up in Poe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the black cat.
Yeah. But absolutely, I mean, to fool the players, you would have to maybe have, not a red herring, but another NPC to kind of take the heat,
mm-hmm.
to draw their attention away from the person that had the alter ego.
Or it could be, I'm thinking of the usual suspects, it could be a figure that the PCs never actually see. Both
wholly fictional, yeah.
Yeah, completely fictional. And that could be the person who is helping them, or the villain. Like, I'm thinking of like a mentor figure. Because mm-hmm. a lot of games have, you know, like you can take a mentor. And that doesn't mean you have to actually be in contact with the mentor or physical contact. Like, they don't have to be there in the party. You could be corresponding with someone via letters. Or it could just be kind of, I don't know, emails in the modern world, you know, or some kind of beneficiary that you can go to for help, but is not expected to go on the adventure with you. And mm-hmm. in that case, either the villain or the person who's helpful to you could be the alter ego. You know, like maybe the villain feels so incredibly guilty that he's doing this that he actually writes letters or, you know, leaves things in drop boxes or, you know, other places for the PCs to find to
that's awesome.
Try and stop himself, essentially.
Well, that's a good idea. It's almost like a calling card.
Mm.
Like a Batman villain where they always have that, they have to leave some sort of clue. And that's part of their psychosis, you know. They mm-hmm. have to let everybody know that they were the one that committed this crime.
Right, mm-hmm. and instead of being like, you know, instead of bragging about it and being kind of grandiose, it's a cry for help, you know. That little part
that's
of
awesome.
Them that says, please catch me.
His alter ego could actually be the good person.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That would actually be more Poe-X, because that brings into the haunted nature.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
So, Now, what about an alter ego for the players, though?
I was thinking about that, but that's kind of, I don't know, it seems almost cliche because it's been done a lot. I was thinking specifically of kind of, you know, the police investigator who finds out that they're the ones doing the murders at night kind of thing.
I think that's tricky because in a game, or in most traditional games, the players have direct control over their characters. And that's pretty much all they have control over, generally. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of players don't like losing control of that one thing in the game they have control over. So I think that's why a lot of players dislike the, oh, and you have an alter ego, or you're doing things at night, or you're, you know, possessed and doing these things. Whatever excuse to get their character to do something that the player doesn't get a say in. So, mm-hmm. I don't know, I think that could be really hard to do.
Yeah, I could see some players bristling against it because you might be taking away some of their agency or some of the way they define their characters. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I can see a lot of players that would really enjoy the opportunity to play that kind of a dual thing, you know, let the player in on the secret themselves, you know, and have them play it up but doing the evil.
I agree with you 100%, Wayne, about the taking the control. But like Chris said, I also agree that some players would really want to run with that. Mm. Now, a lot of systems already have that in it. I mean, in Call of Cthulhu, they're going to turn into, you know, they could end up having it, like, thrust upon them. Although in that game, that generally means game over.
Right.
Mm.
But if you look at, like, Rifts, you've got a character that has to start with something. Vampire Requiem and World of Darkness in general, they have stuff about derangements. Mm. And some characters actually have to start with one.
Right.
And a lot of people do gravitate towards the multiple personalities because that seems like it's fun. Mm-hmm. Like bipolar and things like that seem very mundane.
Echoalia.
and Echoalia as Chris played.
Never in, doing that again.
In Eclipse Phase. That just kind of punished the other players at the table. Whereas multiple personality seems like, not to make light of this psychosis, seems like the fun one to play.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, nobody wants to play Catatonia. Okay, you're out for a week. Yeah. Oh, you're depressed. Okay, you can't get out of bed. Oh, really? Mm-hmm. No, you can't.
So, who wants to play this bedridden guy?
No. Yeah, you can get out of bed to crawl into that whiskey bottle, and that's it. So, I mean, so some players really, really gravitate towards it, and people who decide to choose it, like, really talk to them about, okay, how are we going to play this?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to make it where suddenly you just speak in a Scottish accent or a woman's voice for a session, because mm-hmm. that's not really what this is about. It's not a lot of fun.
Right.
What is this going to make you do? How much control am I going to have? And there's certainly the rules in the game, but you should really talk to them, like, outside of the rules and say, do you want blackouts? Mm. Do you actually want your alter ego and all that stuff to happen outside of the game, in a sense, or away from the table as blackouts? And you actually, your main guy is not aware of it.
Right.
Or do you want to be involved? And do you want it triggered by a dice roll? Or do you want me to trigger it because it'd be good for the story?
You know? Yeah. Mm. Would you like different mental stats for your different personalities?
Yeah, I was actually thinking different stats. Mm. Now, you're saying World of Darkness made me think of Wraith, where I forget what they call it, but one of the other players at the table is supposed to play your character's, I guess, alter ego that's out to get you and mess up all your plans. And that always seemed interesting to me, but it also means that you have to be really okay with that, because mm-hmm. there will be another player playing your character, doing whatever they want, and I could see that breaking some groups.
Yeah, I agree. Before we go get too far away from the topic, just one quick thing. If anybody's interested in a game example of this kind of alter ego thing, check out the Vampire the Masquerade computer game, PC game. It's quite old now, but one of the NPCs that you deal with has an alter ego, and it's amazing. The reveal is really good. So I won't spoil anything, but if you're interested, check it out.
Apart from there being a reveal. Oh. Now anyone who goes back and plays that game is going to be like, is it this guy?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And I ended up tracking down those floppy disks and finding a hard drive that could actually fit.
Not quite that old, but it was back in the day when it would come on a CD, yeah.
Well, continuing with people who, you know, would act against you, one of Poe's themes is monsters, and not necessarily monsters just for the sake of their being supernatural creatures, but in the dark romantic genre, monsters are often a analogy for the nature of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the dark romantic's adapted image is of anthropomorphized evil in the form of Satan, devils, ghosts, werewolves, and ghouls. So I'm drawing a blank on there being any supernatural monsters in Poe's stories, but there are non-human entities. You know, the cat, and you brought up a good one, where the heart in the Telltale Heart could also be considered kind of an entity. And they're representations of evil rather than being what they actually are.
Yeah, when you first brought it up, I actually didn't follow along, and I was thinking, because it's the same thing. I couldn't think of any demons or devils in any of Poe's stories. But yeah, the more you think about it, you're right. In other gothic horror stories, those kinds of supernatural monsters, they represent some of the dark sides of humanity. But Poe, instead, he represents these dark sides of humanity as kind of extreme examples, but still within humanity. Even though there are also other things like the raven, the heart, and the telltale heart that aren't human, but they are still, you know, specific vectors through which he's showing these human emotions.
Right. The other one I thought of was the cat in the story, the black cat, which, in my opinion, like the heart in the telltale heart, is an expression of guilt.
Yep.
You know, manifested in something outside of the author.
Well, you know, there's one example, I think it's pronounced Ligeia, L-I-G-E-I-A, where it's, the house takes on these kinds of personalities. Well, not just the house. Okay. In the story, the character's wife dies, and, he's so racked over guilt about it that his memories kind of begin to manifest in the real world. So, for example, while he's, in bed at night, the architecture around the room, the furniture and the patterns on the walls, they all begin to take on visages of his wife, and it kind of builds and builds until eventually, more stuff happens. But, yeah, so it's not just creatures or humanity themselves, but in Poe's world, these emotions, they are the monsters. They are real, and they have different vectors of manifesting themselves. But yeah, that's what the monsters are.
No, I think that's a good point, and I mean, that could be its own theme. It's just the emotions and the motivations.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very relatable. I mean, what in the cast of...
Amontillado.
Yeah, that's the one. We're looking at revenge. And other things like that. Like, people can relate to that. People, you know, they get slighted.
Mm-hmm.
Angry over some sort of insult. And then, I mean, you go crazy. Sometimes, I mean, think about what you do. I mean, Stephen King, sorry, not to bring up another author, but he put it really well as, like, why he was such a good horror writer. Is like, when somebody cuts him off, and those thoughts of, I'm going to track him down and cut off his head and bury his body, he would, I mean, like everybody else, doesn't actually act on those thoughts.
Hmm.
But he writes them down.
I don't have those thoughts.
Oh, and you same do as, somewhere.
Oh, whatever, whatever. And the same with Poe. I mean, somebody insults him, he probably then plots that person's murder.
Hmm.
Like a lot of people do, but most people don't act on that. And he writes it down, and then people read the story and goes, yeah, that's how I felt.
You know, I wanted to so brick that guy up in the basement.
Yeah, brick him up. Yeah, 50 years. How you like me now? and again, it gets back into the perhaps not very well phrased or not very well explained thing about in the restaurant that we talked about earlier. But just, you know, emotions, you know, are the big enemy,
mm-hmm.
and the thing that can really bring people into a story.
That would be...
We hadn't discussed this, but you saying that, Lyle, makes me think of, again, going back to what makes a good villain. Oftentimes, it's the guy whose plan is completely relatable. And you're like, yeah, you know, when that big reveal comes, the players are like, what you did makes total sense. I can see exactly why you did what you did.
I so would have done that,
exactly. And that's the other thing. Like, if I had been in that position, perhaps I would have done that too. You know, or if a few things had been different in my life, I would have been in the same place you are, where
mm-hmm.
that is a lot better than the convoluted plan that no one can follow and doesn't make sense. And, you know, you're just like, oh, well, why did you do that? So I think you're absolutely right, Lyle, that relatable kind of character is really important.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's a place for the over-the-top villain who wants to bring this demon into the world so that person can rule at their side. And sure, but there's also the thing was, oh, you're already a multi-billionaire, and you own a mega corporation and control the government. So why do you need that extra thing? But I mean, but there is a place for that. But what if then you add that one extra element? Oh, it's all about this need for revenge, or the person is a racist or something like that. Like they have something that you see every day, and then you're like, okay. I understand now. Or they're really lonely. I don't know. Yeah.
Hmm. I wonder if that'd be a fun way to build up a game to start where instead of saying, you know, my big bad guy is going to be, this fighter or a wizard or something, a demon, something like that. But just to start off by saying, my bad guy is going to be revenge. My big bad evil guy is going to be fear. You kind of build from that.
That could be a good way to, like, you know, when you're planning something or even have a series of themes and people don't know what the emotions are, but they know it's going to be something like that.
Hmm.
Yeah. So you don't even have to tell the players, but they find out afterwards after a series of campaigns or mini campaigns, and each one had its own emotion. Yeah, it'd be like a work of art, really.
A collage, as it were.
and then you're like the madman at the end. And then Game Master, and you've all been playing my little game. And you reveal the wall covered with stuff. Which, by the way, why do people like throw things on the wall, like maps and pictures? Oh, that's such a cliche.
What you mean, like the strings and threads going to all the different points on the map on all the different walls? So you have like this spider web when someone walks into the
room. And the red marker writing on it and everything.
Yeah, but you realize that the reason that when they show that, they're trying to show that this person is crazy because normal people don't do that.
Yep, you beat me to it, Chris.
you're absolutely right, and I understand why they do it, but then I watched a movie, and I'm just drawing a blank right now, where the person wasn't crazy. That's just how they planned, and they went to the person's room, and they found everything's on the wall. It wasn't like crazy, like, you know, mummy, right, or anything written on it. But that's how they planned. Like, unlike most people just planning on a computer or keeping things very secretive and locked away, they just throw it up on the wall of a motel room. Hmm. And so I don't know whether they tell the cleaning lady. It's like, change the sheets, but don't touch the stuff on the wall.
Yeah.
Do not disturb secret plans.
is that the White House blueprint? No, it's already off topic, but. So emotions as a driver for a game, as the antagonist in a game. I think that's where we left off.
Or even as, you know, kind of the whole center of the game. You remember my idea? Rage Mage? Yeah?
Yes, we remember that. that would be in Inspirations.
Yes.
The episode of Inspirations.
Mm-hmm.
I got to come up with a catchy one for Jealousy.
Green.
Yeah, green. I'm thinking that too. Green.
Green mean green. I don't know.
The Green Guild. I don't know.
Do you want to go into Curiosity?
No, I'm still thinking of a Jealousy. I'm thinking of all these like character types that I could rhyme it with something.
The Brighter Fighter.
The Lizard Wizard, because he's green.
Oh, that's a stretch.
Danger Ranger.
It was better than my Brogue Rogue, because that took, you know... Like, you know, you speak in a brogue.
Right.
Like, because... So who speaks it? Irish people speak in a brogue, right?
Right.
Yes.
And green is their color. God!
How deep this rabbit hole goes.
All the way. Watch our descent into madness, much like one of Poe's characters.
That was just 6 degrees of, I don't care.
Yeah, right. Go to Lyle's room, he's got all these character sheets taped to the wall with red thread between them.
And the map of Ireland. Yeah, we finally got there. And then Jealousy.
Yeah, he's got all the emotions on one wall and like pinned all these pictures on the other ones. Yeah.
So yeah, Gothic horror.
And since we're talking about emotions, I suppose curiosity would be an emotion, or at least a state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so close enough.
Yeah, that'll work.
And that is a theme in Poe stuff. And one thing, unlike our first literature lessons, which was Lovecraft, where curiosity is just a bad thing. You don't want to be curious.
But you are. Otherwise, there's no story.
Yeah. Well, but in Poe, curiosity can be a good thing. Where, like, in the Goldblug, the person's rewarded by being curious and deciphering clues.
Hmm.
And Wayne actually had a good point about why he put in, like, these little clues and ciphers in his books.
Yeah, like, you mentioned at the beginning that Poe was kind of a popularist, and I think I read somewhere that he didn't particularly enjoy writing gothic fiction, but that's just what was popular at the time. And at the time he wrote The Goldbug, ciphers were a really, really big deal. And so to kind of capitalize on that wave, hey, he made a story that allowed him to put a cipher in, which was The Goldbug. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, I mean, the character doesn't descend into madness necessarily, like in a Lovecraft book, but they find the solution to, or they can stave off the imminent destruction.
Actually, yeah, that's a really good point. In, how was it, The Pit and the Pendulum, then that actually is specifically that. The character's curiosity is the very thing that allows him to avoid going mad in his cell.
We've seen this in other stories as well, not necessarily Poe's, where focusing on something...
Mm-hmm.
And trying to solve some sort of solution keeps the character sane.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot going around, and they might comment on other characters, you know, how can you do that in a in a time like this? And they're like, this is the only thing that keeps me from going crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be something really, really cool to have in a game. It's sort of the anti-Lovecraft.
Hmm.
Where Lovecraft, it's a crazy world, and the more you try to unlock it, you're going to go insane. And in Poe, it's a crazy world or a crazy situation, and the more you try to unlock it, you have a good chance of, you know, keeping your sanity and finding a solution.
Absolutely. It's one of those things, like, I've said before that I'm not the biggest fan of Lovecraft because I don't, the drive there doesn't seem to do it for me. You know, being punished for being curious is not something that I can empathize with very well.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the opposite, not always with Poe, but in many cases with Poe, curiosity is an important driving factor, and that's something that a lot of games rely on. When the party stumbles across a dungeon or a cave opening or something, then the inclination is often to go inside it, not to say, oh, well, that's probably dangerous, let's go back to the city and go to the bar. So that's something that it's a very important human emotion, and that's one of the things that you almost have to rely on in a game. So, yeah, you should reward it, as Poe does. But it doesn't have to be kind of this overt great reward, like you went into the cave, here's your treasure. It's, as you mentioned, Lyle, it can be the thing that kind of keeps you from going bad or keeps bad things from happening.
Mm.
Another kind of, I guess, opposition to H.P. Lovecraft. There are characters in Poe's stories that do go mad.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason. But that reason is almost always internal. Like, it's not anything outside that makes them snap. It's things like their own guilt or their own sense of frustration or fear or whatever. Whereas in Lovecraft, it's very much, oh no, you read the Necronomicon, or you figured out what's outside the world, and it breaks your mind and you go insane. So, yeah, I kind of saw Poe as kind of a little bit of the opposite of Lovecraft for that reason as well.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, Lovecraft wants to create images and situations and have antagonists that are otherworldly, that you can't comprehend. They can't even, the narrator can't even explain it.
Right.
And it breaks your mind. Whereas Poe wants, and again, it could be because he wants people to read the books. He wants people to understand exactly what's going on and really place themselves in that situation. And sometimes, you know, good things happen from curiosity. You know, sometimes somebody insults you and you go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people sometimes do fall deeply in love with somebody to the point where they do stupid things and crazy things. So, so all of it, very, very relatable.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing, is that relatability, it's the internality. It's much more realistic in Poe, and because of that, much more frightening, at least in my opinion.
Well, speaking of frightening, I think that's, again, another reason why Poe does that is the whole idea of kind of like gothic horror or that dark romanticism is that one of the big themes there is man's fallibility. So that descent into madness just kind of is part of that theme where, like, nope, human beings kind of aren't that strong, and a lot of times they're not that good, and this descent into madness or these really strong emotions that lead to foolish things or tragic situations are just in man's nature, and deal with it.
Yeah. Small side thing to say as well, though, even though we praise Poe for his rewarding of curiosity, there are quite a few of his stories where the opposite is true. One of his most famous, The Raven, obviously. The guy is curious at what's that strange knocking at his door, and that's what eventually leads to his fall into madness. So, not always.
Pretty direct. Oh, what's it knocking at the door? Oh, Raven. Oh, no.
Yeah. I'm crazy!
Yeah, we have a game. Somebody's knocking at the door. I don't know what to do. Answer it, not answer it. I don't know. Wait. What kind of game are we playing? Are we playing Lovecraft or Poe? I don't know.
Great, so if we're playing Lovecraft, that means if I open the door, something will break my mind. If we're playing Poe, then I'm going to sit here and agonize about it until not answering the door and the thought of what's on the other side drives me insane.
Then again, if we're playing Poe and I answer it, then maybe a good thing will happen. Ah! What if we're playing Stephen King? I don't know. I don't know anymore. Oh, they stopped knocking. You see, it was the UPS guy. But was he?
Now you get into the, what was in the box?
What was in the box? Now, if it was Stephen King. Now, like all things, we're going to end with death.
That wasn't cheesy.
Yeah. I'm not sure we will keep that in. It should come as no surprise in the types of stories that Poe wrote that death was a pretty prominent theme.
Mm-hmm.
I guess one of the twists would be how things have power beyond life. Like you made references to the Telltale Heart.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, power beyond the grave. And not necessarily like zombies rising out of the grave to attack the person or a vampire coming back, but just the person's guilt or...
Yeah, well, even we keep referencing it, but the black cat, the cat, in a sense, comes back. Because, spoiler, you know, the cat dies in the fire, and then another cat that looks very similar to the first one shows up. And it's probably a different cat, but, hey, who really knows? And that, again, the unreliable narrator kind of starts associating it with the original cat who came back from the dead. Or... Mm-hmm. Like, it's not exactly the same, but in The Fall of the House of Usher, the narrator's friend's sister has these kind of, like, medical problems where she falls into, like, a catatonic state. And, you know, of course, during the story, she falls into one of these states, and the narrator's friend says, oh, no, she's actually dead. And so they, you know, wall her up in the crypts. And, of course, she actually wasn't dead. But, I mean, that's... A logical explanation for how something can have power after death is that, oh, surprise, it wasn't actually dead, you know. Mm-hmm. But, no, I think there's definitely something there.
Well, premature burial, that was something that Poe and a lot of people were afraid of at that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hey, I'm still scared of that. That's pretty spooky. I mean, not that I have a medical problem that makes me appear to be dead, but still.
Yeah, it'd be pretty hard to... I mean, I suppose it still happens, but if you're cremated, you wouldn't have to worry about that.
Well, no, except when you actually get loaded into the thing, you're like, oh,
The actual cremation itself, though.
Yeah. No, there's a channel here that plays pretty much NCIS nonstop. And, of course, one of the, I think it was NCIS or something, where they, you know, they do the thing where, like, this person's not actually dead because they had some kind of, you know, drug or chemical that puts them in a completely catatonic state where they appear dead, but they're actually still alive. So,
Yeah.
Modern way to do it.
Wolverine does that, the first movie. Or I remember CSI Miami, where she's about the actual pathologist.
Yeah.
Is at the crime scene. She's about to stick in the liver thermometer. And then David Caruso is actually standing away from the body. And she's leaning over the body. He's like, hold on. He's sweating.
And then they do the wow! And he puts on his sunglasses.
maybe he says something better, like... why is he sweating? Whatever. And of course, you have to have the pathologist go, oh, I can't believe I almost stuck in my liver thermometer. I mean, how stupid would that? Yeah, that's pretty dumb.
Well, no, they did that to make David Caruso look awesome.
Yeah. You know?
But don't do something that cheesy in your game, because that's going to
Please.
Okay, make a roll. Okay, you notice he's sweating. Really? Like, we checked his pulse and everything, and now we notice he's sweating? Yeah, whatever. Just run with it.
Seems like that natural 20 was unnatural. But one of the things, getting back to good stuff, one of the things that I find interesting about Poe, the way Poe handles death, is that the dead are more powerful in his stories, but it's not a case so much of them being ghosts or creatures come back from death. Mm. It's more the memories of these people that are haunting the characters. And in a lot of cases, these memories become manifest. Again, like the black cat, where his guilt projects itself onto the cat. Or in that one I was talking about, Ligia, or however you pronounce it, where he sees his dead wife in the dark corners of the room, but it's only his memory that's pulling it back.
You know, I'm gonna say Ligia.
You reckon?
Yeah, I don't know. But
I'll take your word for it. I have no idea.
I'm gonna say Ligia, but I could be wrong. Okay.
But yeah, that's the thing. And I really like that about Poe's stories, in that it's such a subtle kind of horror, and a subtle kind of danger. It's not something that's coming after you. It's within yourself. So how do you stop something like that?
You can also show the power of love.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Just to bring this full circle. I mean, that's a strong motivator. That's from the book Ligeia, where the memory of the dead shows that the power of love resists even death.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So we get into the motivation of an antagonist, but it could also be the motivation of the protagonist, and really play into that. I mean, you've lost a loved one, so this is going to drive you in what, which direction? In a positive direction, in a negative direction?
Mm-hmm.
But this person's still alive because, in a sense, because you remember them.
Yeah. I was in The Raven too, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, over the lost love of Lenore.
Well, I mean,
Nevermore.
You can't really talk about Poe and death and not look at his life. I mean, his mother died when he was 2, then like his wife died
when he was 3.
No, not when he was 3. Although his wife was 13 when they got married. So I'll just say that. And was his cousin as well. So, no,
Don't judge.
Yep. No, there was a lot of actual death in Poe's life. So it's no mystery about why he writes about that.
Mm-hmm.
Just glad he didn't write about pedophilia with his wife being 13.
I bet you that was young even for back then.
Especially since he was less, something like 26 or something.
Not that really sure that. What to do with
that. Yep,
that
ended that.
We power have, of death, pedophilia, yeah.
We have love talked about that all. In past episodes, but...
Don't need to explore it. We just cut out that last part.
I'm still thinking about that 13-year-old. Yeah. Actually, that one thing, how to work that in, is just the very unsympathetic. And actually, Chris, you're doing this in our Pathfinder game, the very unsympathetic NPC.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
Where you're like, oh, that's horrible. What's going to happen? And then you find out more, and you're like, hold on. You actually have to pull Wayne's character off the guy.
Yeah, right. Like,
so you're only doing this because of selfish motive. Like, okay. Still a bad thing happening.
Come on. Yeah, right.
All right.
No, but I mean, that's good. I mean, we have a complex NPC to deal with, which now makes our subsequent actions more interesting, because we don't know when to go to them or not go to them. I mean, if it was a very black and white or a very pure NPC, you could easily just go to them and it's like, oh, this is the right thing to do. Oh, I'll back you up 100%. But we don't know if we can do that with this person, because clearly they're motivated by very human and very real emotions. You know, the power of love of a father for his daughter. Mm. Whereas before, he was making decisions by what was more expedient or better for the town.
Yeah, I'm happy with it. And actually, I'm really happy the way that Wayne's playing a paladin, so kind of the goody-two-shoes. Two shoes stuck up thing, and I really like the interplay.
Wayne was playing a paladin.
All right.
That's true. That stopped last one.
Sorry, I gotta tell this. Where my character, the rogue, walks into where Yujiro and Wayne's characters were, and we're interrogating this guy, and then threatening him with death. And then out of character, I do say to turn to Wayne and say, are you going to try to stop me? And he's like, no, why? And then I think Yujiro pipes up, no, he slit the throat of all these other guys. I said, oh, I thought that was you.
Nope, that was me.
And then Chris is trying to help him, saying, yeah, but your temple's like revenge or something. No, mercy, mercy. Temple of mercy and kindness.
Hey.
Forgiveness.
Well, for what it's worth, he didn't actually slit their throats. He just stabbed a sword through their sleeping chest.
Yeah. They were associating with ghouls and other fun things, you know. Hey, we said how love can turn to hate real fast. And wait, there you go. I'm just playing a Poe-esque character. Oh, man. I'm so valorous. And no, I really hate these guys.
All right, well, that wraps up our latest literature lesson, and the focus, of course, was Edgar Allan Poe. It also wraps up our month of horror, so this will upload just before Halloween.
Yep.
So next month will be our month of remembrance. It's Remembrance Day. No, it won't be our month of remembrance. It will be just a month of our usual stuff.
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through Stitcher or off of iTunes, or you can download it off of DriveThruRPG. Once again, our email is info@idleredhands.com, or you can send us an email because we'd love hearing from all of you guys, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter, or send us a message through either of those because we'd love hearing from all of you. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Stay spooky.
Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-through RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.